Good evening. As mentioned last lecture, the collapse of the old world shtetl and the subsequent rise of new non-Torah observant movements in Western Europe, we illustrate that the ideas, practices, and debates of the period of that period of the Enlightenment and post-Napoleon leads to the current denominational structure in our day. But to be frank, that is a little bit incomplete. Because today, when we discuss Eastern Europe and the Haskalah in Eastern Europe, we'll get the full picture. The Napoleonic Enlightenment, which emancipated the Jews of Western Europe, did not reach Russia. Of course, as mentioned last lecture, Russia was attacked by Napoleon, but in 1812, in the winter of 1812, Napoleon lost most of his army in Russia, and subsequently, any measures which had been taken to that point were pushed back. The largest concentrations of Jews in the beginning of the 19th century was in Eastern Europe. Approximately 40% of worldwide Jewry and the vast majority of Ashkenazic Jewry lived in what is called the Pale of Settlement. The Polish partitions, which happened between the years of 1772 and 1815, totally changed the fabric of Russian Jewry. Because until that point, Jews in Russia were relatively a small minority. But starting in 1772, 750,000 more Jews were added from what was Poland-Lithuania into the Russian Empire. When Catherine the Great first accumulated all of these new Jews, she did not treat them negatively. She gave actually some opportunities to be part of Russian Orthodox society. And she levied taxes on the Jews, but not extreme. And if a Jew would have, God forbid, converted to Russian Orthodoxy, they would have full permission to do anything and everything and be part of society. Catherine included them under the rights and laws of the Charter of Towns in 1782. And this presented certain benefits to the Jews who started to become economically successful. Consequently, the Russian Orthodox middle class started to clamor against the Jews. So accordingly, just 3 years later, in 1785, Catherine declared the Jews are officially foreigners with foreigners' rights. This reestablished a separate identity for Jews in the Russian Empire, and Catherine slowly but surely pushed the Jews farther and farther out of the Russian economic circle. And in 1791, established the Pale of a Settlement. From 1791 until 1915, the majority of Jews living in Eastern Europe were confined by all of the czars of Russia to an area called the Pale of a Settlement. The Pale of a Settlement literally means the borders of the settlement. The Pale comprised approximately 20% of the former Russian Empire, which included the present-day Lithuania, Belarus, White Russia, Moldova, Ukraine, and parts of Western Russia. A number of cities were in the Pale, where in the actual areas of the Pale, Jews were excluded from living in. A limited amount of Jews were allowed to live in the cities of the Pale, not just the shtetls. But later, more and more Jews were pushed out of the cities of the Pale. And Jews were living at the time of Catherine in Moscow and St. Petersburg were expelled from both Moscow and St. Petersburg. In comparison, when Poland was split in 1772, part of Poland went to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. That part of Poland became known as Galicia. In Galicia, the Jews fared a lot better, especially in the late 19th century, under the Emperor Franz Joseph, the Jews did fine. They were economically sound. That's because they did not have constant economic laws against them. They had freedom at some level. It's not like the freedoms we have today. They had freedoms at some level to partake in the economy of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is why Galician Jews were much more advanced socioeconomically than Russian Jews. Taxes doubled again on Jews in 1794, and once again Catherine reiterated in 1794 that Jews are not Russians. We are not citizens of Russia. Jews are different. We are separate. We are not part of the country. Just to jump ahead 100 years, by 1886, not only were Jews not part of the country, there were severe quotas on Jews reaching higher education. In the Pale, that was limited to 10%. In outside the Pale, 5% of colleges let Jews. And in Moscow and St. Petersburg and Kiev, only 3% of the university population was allowed to be Jews. Now, to jump way ahead, during World War I, the Pale lost its dominance of the Jewish population. That's because when the Germans came marching in, the Jewish population ran into the interior of Russia and went farther than they were before. And of course, the Russian Empire at the time was on the brink. And in 1917, with the provisional government, with the February government of 1917, before the communist revolution, the Pale was officially abolished with the government decree on abolition of the confessional and national restrictions, and the Pale, with its Jewish population, was abolished. Also, at the end of the World War I, this is jumping ahead, but it's very important, one of the most remarkable things happened, and that is that a large part of what was the Pale settlement, including Poland and Lithuania, were ripped out of the Russian Empire. That area included approximately 4.5 million Jews who were saved between 1917 and 1939 from communism, and including the vast majority of all yeshivas. Because had Trotsky was forced with Lenin to sign a deal in the middle to get out, they gave away to Germany, although Germany didn't get it. It was Poland and Lithuania, Latvia. Had those countries remained under the Russian Empire, maybe we don't think about this, they would have been communist starting in essentially by 1920, the war was largely over. They would have been communist. The 19 years between World War I and World War II were years where the yeshivas were dominant, and they were able to escape to both America, to Israel. Of course, the Mir Yeshiva, we'll talk about it in a different lecture, was able to get to Shanghai. If those countries had not been given up in 1917, almost all of Ashkenazic Jewry would have been under the communists by 1920. By Hashkacha, by divine providence, Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia had very few Jews. They were taken out of the Russian Empire just when communism came to the front. Now, going back to the Pale Settlement, you would think in the Pale Settlement always bleary and always gloomy. There were Martin Gilbert, the English historian, if you look at his Illustrated History of the World, it's an interesting book. So he points out that in no province in the Pale had less than 14% of the Jews on relief. And in Lithuania, in Ukraine, there was as much as 22% of the population was on support. But they were totally, utterly supported internally by the Jewish communities. And the Jews supported themselves. Among the charitable societies organized by Jews, this is a quote from Gilbert, among the charitable societies organized by Jews in the Pale were those to supply poor students with clothes, soldiers with kosher food, the poor with free medical treatment, poor brides with dowries, and orphans with technical education. They had a tremendous social welfare system. They took care of one of each other without the federal government forcing them to tax each other. Jews took care of each other, others. An interesting thing is, if you look in the Pale, there were takanas, there were decrees, no conversion. Now, at first glance, you'd say, why no conversion? Because amongst the few conversions that were in the 19th century, to convert to Judaism in Catholic Poland, or Russian Orthodox Russia, or Lithuania, was a death sentence. It was illegal. It was illegal. The famous Graf Pataki was one of the Russian noblemen. He was killed for converting to Judaism, and others as well. basically it's like converting today in Saudi Arabia to Christianity or to Judaism. They would kill you. In all of Catholic Europe, it was forbidden under heresy laws to convert to Judaism. Same thing in Russian Orthodoxy. But there's another reason why conversion was banned. That's because if you were a Russian peasant and you weren't making it, do you know what happened to you? If you got sick, you died on the street. If you couldn't support yourself, you know what happened to you? You starved to death. Well, if they looked at the Jews took care of each other. You know, it's like this famous story in New York. This has happened more than once. I can know firsthand. You know, you see someone on the tribe row, the car is broken, and he's wearing a yarmulke, and a religious Jew pulls up to help him out, and he says, Shalom Aleichem. The guy has a Puerto Rican accent. And he says, oh, thanks so much for coming. My car is broken. And he sees the guy, yarmulke. He says, what synagogue do you down there? Oh, no, I'm Puerto Rican. I'm Catholic. He says, what do you wear a yarmulke? He says, I know. If I get stuck, I put on one of these. I get car stuck and run away. Right? So, you know, the Puerto Ricans know this in New York. They want to get a hand from a yarmulke. You get people stopping. Well, the Russian peasants knew that if they want to be taken care of, you convert to Judaism, you're a Jew. Better to risk, you know, most cases, they didn't know who converted. Some Russian peasant disappeared and converted. No, at least I get a warm meal. Someone offered me a blanket. The Jews took care of each other. So there's actually there's so much of a desire to convert, and it was a danger to the Jewish community that they banned conversion for many times. Also, in the Pale Settlement, there were Hasidic courts with hundreds of thousands of Jews. Certainly in Poland, what's called Congressional Poland, which was under Russian dominion, but less so. And we'll see, even the Cantonist decrees were not really what's called Congressional Poland. There was the Ger Hasidim with tens of thousands, and by the beginning of the 20th century, hundreds of thousands of followers. Vizhnitz, there was Square Hasidim, there was Charkov, Alexander Hasidim, hundreds of thousands, but cumulatively millions of Hasidim in Vilna and in Kovno. In the other cities of Lithuania, there were the Mesnagdic Torah centers. That is how the 19th century starts. But in the 19th century, in Russia, although the Enlightenment would not get there, Haskalah would start to creep in, and that would permanently change the world of Russia. Because when the 19th century in Russia starts, 99% of Russian Jews are Torah observant. 99% approximately of Russian Jews are Torah observant. That doesn't mean they're all tzaddikim, they're all pious. Certainly, they have their vices and foibles, but on a outward level, if you looked in the street, they were Torah observant. Some were more religious, some were less. But ideologically, sociologically, you would call them Orthodox. That was not the case by far 100 years later. What was Haskalah? Haskalah comes from the word seichel, intellect. It was called the Jewish Enlightenment. It was an ideological and social movement that developed in Eastern European Jews in the 18th and 19th centuries that advocated adopting Enlightenment values, pressing for better integration into European society, and increasing education in secular studies, Hebrew language and Yiddish, and Jewish history. In certain senses, Haskalah was an extension of the 18th century European Enlightenment, but it was centrally concerned with Jews. Essentially, Haskalah tried to exploit the Jews to new possibilities in a world that they were trying to create. Leaders and partisans of the Haskalah movement were called maskilim. It was a relatively vigorous and dangerous movement, if you ask me, until the rise of the nationalistic movements in the late 1880s. As long as Jews lived in segregated communities, the shtetls, the pale, and as long as social intercourse with Gentile neighbors was relatively limited, usually from the outside, the most important figure and the role model of all was the rabbi. If you wanted to know the structure, the hierarchy of 19th century, the 19th century Russian Jewry, certainly in Lithuania, certainly in the Hasidic courts, Well, where did it all end up with? It was the Rebbe, the Vilna Gaons, the Rekive Egers, the great leaders of all this system. And every Jewish kid in the town, if you'd ask them, what do you want to be? Like today, you go to a kid, what do you want to be? I want to be in a rocket ship. I want to be a policeman. I want to be in the Air Force in Silicon Valley. I want to be Steve Jobs or Sergey Brin or something of the sort. In those days, thank you, I always wonder, am I actually allergic to this class? Because somehow or other, I always get sick around these classes. But I think it's just the winter. Call me after Baruch. Haskalah tried to break that. They wanted the Jews to come out to the world. They tried to change Judaism. Haskalah, of course, it starts in 19th century Germany, but German Haskalah soon gives way to mass assimilation and conversion, as discussed last lecture, and to reform. And what's called Haskalah in Germany dies. However, the movement will spread to Eastern Europe. Now, the difference between Reform Judaism and Haskalah is as follows. Reform tried to create the classic assimilationist Jew. It was unlikely that most Reform Jews, you can read the liturgy, as I mentioned last lecture, did not imagine their great-grandchildren being Jewish. They didn't imagine. It wasn't part of it, and if it didn't happen, it didn't bother them. There is very little Judaism about Reform Judaism. It was an accommodation. It was about having some Jewish rights. Haskalah was Jewish culture. It attempted to redefine Jewish life. Jewish life. A Reformed Jew was a German first, as mentioned last time. First a German, then a Jew. Judaism was not focused on. Judaism was relegated. Haskalah tried to create what's called a secular Jew. Thus, secular Haskalah laid claim to the Bible, biblical literature, studying Jewish history and historiography, it also contested the traditional vision of a Jewish future with a Weltanschauung that was irreverent to the Jewish past, completely irreverent to a Jewish past, and largely non-believing of a Jewish future. It didn't care that much about the grandchildren, but it wanted to focus on the culture of Judaism. And we'll discuss that in a minute. Where does the Haskalah start? Well, if you remember, Galicia is by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and that was taken over by the Austro-Hungarian. You know, I think I want to mention this, that Galicia was Poland, which was taken over by Austro-Hungary. So, in the Poland, and afterwards came back to Poland, my grandparents, all four of them, were Polish Jews, and they used to always say that the world was, on top was Poland, below that was Galicia, and the lowest was Hungary. So when I got married to my wife, so my wife's grandfather was from a very Lithuanian home, it was a rabbinic home in Lithuania, but her grandmother came from a Hungarian home. And my wife was telling over what my grandparents used to say, that Poland's on the top, and Galicia's in the middle, and Hungary is on the bottom. She said, that's funny, because in Hungary I learned that Hungary was on the top, Galicia's in the middle, and Poland was on the bottom. But Galicia was always in the middle. And Galicia was right next to Germany. And the first place where the Maskilim would infiltrate would be Galicia. And not only because Galicia was proximity-wise closer to it, but it was culturally closer to it, and it had a middle class. Because Galicia, as mentioned, was Nagar Russia. And they had a more of a wealthy class. And they were more open to be absorbed into society. So in certain towns, mainly Brody, Lemberg, which is Lvov, and Tarnopol, where there was a Jewish social and economic elite, including several mercantile and banking families, they supported a young Haskalah movement. And the beneficiaries of this movement were mostly the few college students that were there in their 20s and 30s. Regular meetings were held in the homes of infamous individuals, such as Nachman Krochmal and Dovber Ginsburg and Brody. And they wrote in several journals what the Maskilim were very good at was propaganda. They disseminated, they were writers. And of course, if you have newspapers, especially in those days, and it's unbelievable, people come to me, even, you know, just for example, if you ever meet a Christian or a non-Jew who doesn't know that much about the Middle East, doesn't know that much, if all they read is MoveOn.org or the New York Times, they'll get a very distorted. No, they won't ever understand Israel. Why? They're reading the wrong publication. They're getting a jaundiced view. Well, imagine this. If most of the periodicals are going to come out by the Maskilim in the beginning, right, and it would take a few decades till the religious group realized what was happening, they're going to taint the minds of others because they're creating the press. Hey, I once saw a Russian textbook about World War II. As an imagine what it means to grow up, and you read a Russian textbook from the 1970s about World War II, and you read an American textbook, like sometimes you wonder, which war are you reading? It's a different, it was a different textbook. So you grew up in Russia, you're reading a different textbook. Well, the Maskilim were controlling the press. And these people were getting out their word first. What was, especially in Galicia, what was the message of the Maskilim? Their main enemies, because you have to know Galicia became the home of great Hasidic groups, Babel, Belz, Churko was in Galicia, and another Hasidic groups. Their main impetus was against the Hasidim, who were the complete opposite of the Maggi, and in the beginning of the 19th century, Hasidism was spreading like wildfire. So writers such as Joseph Pearl, his every single work was parodied, was making satire and making fun of Hasidim. The Hasidim are this and the Hasidim are that. And he wrote a book called Megillat Hamirim, which is said to be the first modern novel in Hebrew. The first modern novel in Hebrew in 1819, Megillat Hamirim, was a book making fun of Hasidim. And he wrote it under a pseudonym called Abad ibn Patachia. And their struggle failed. In Galicia, actually, the Hasidim won the day. And their whole raison d'etre became just to fight the Hasidim, which is not that appealing. Right? They had no... their whole thing, if you read anything they would write, it was making fun of the Hasidim. But in Russia, it would be a different story. Russia, a Haskalah, would actually bear fruit. Evil fruit. Jewish merchants from Brody, in particular, would be traveling to Odessa. And Odessa would become the center of the Russian Haskalah. And the first great Russian Moscow was called Yitzhak Ber Levinson, it was called the Russian Mendelssohn. Historians break up the Russian Haskalah into three periods, up until 1840, from 1840 to 1855, and from 1855 till really when the Russian nationalistic movements, the Bund, beginning of the communists, socialists, and Zionists, would knock out Haskalah. That was between 1855 and the 1880s. In the beginning, before 1840, the Haskalah in Russia was relatively small. It was primarily located in Odessa and in Vilna. It mostly attracted extraordinarily wealthy merchants. Now, it's not surprising that the most successful Russian Jews would be most attracted by Haskalah. Because, unfortunately, you saw this in Germany as well, when you make it to Bern, when you make it up the ladder of success, and Jews are the low of the low in Russia, they're Jids. They're the Jewish swine. They're the butt of all jokes. They're scorned and laughed and hated. And if Haskalah could change that image a little bit, and you're successful in every business meeting you go to, you, Baron Ginsburg, are reminded you're a kike, you're a jid, you're not that much different than your brothers and sisters and the shtetls. So you have an impetus to maybe, you know, be more Russian. We want to fit in. The first people who wanted to be more Russian is because they wanted to be like everyone else. They didn't want to go to business meetings and be told, look at your poor slovenly cousins and brothers and sisters. Of course, the reason they were poor and slovenly is because they were blocked out of any economic opportunity. They were knocked out of any shot. But the first ones who would be interested in this were people who were constantly confronted with it, and that was the wealthy class. They would sponsor it. they would propagate the books. But in the beginning, for the most part, the Haskalah Russia was moderate. It was almost like Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn, as mentioned at the last lecture, himself was an observant Jew. And Levinson was an observant Jew. He wasn't looking to break the theology of Judaism. He was only looking to finesse Judaism, make Jews more Russian. Well, we should know Tolstoy wasn't around. There's no Russian. But whatever Russian culture there was, dress like Russians, talk Russian, don't speak Yiddish. Right? Learn Russian trades, don't wear a kippah, cut off your beards and pay us. Still pray, still be a good Jew at home. Sounds familiar, like Mendelssohn. But don't be so Jewish. Don't be so Jewish. Maybe they'll like us. The Russians won't call us Jids anymore. They'll welcome us with open arms. They'll invite us to have vodka with them. They won't even kill us at the same time. Okay? Hey, that was the hope. Just be a little bit more abyssal mer Russian. They weren't looking to change it. Now, certain things, they came acutely against Kabbalah, sounded too irrational, so they came against Kabbalah. There was more of a criticism on certain halakhic practices. But they respected Torah study, because Torah study was still an intellectual pursuit. There became a romantic attitude to the Hebrew language, which for hundreds of years was abandoned, as the sole, most valued remnant of a glorious past. So the only thing that was really valuable was the Hebrew language. And the Maskilim put a heavy emphasis on the humanity of Jews and others. Tikkun Olam. And I always thought, if you know, if you look at Reform Judaism, even today, that there's a tremendous emphasis on Tikkun Olam. It happens to be not necessarily a problem in and of itself, because we should care about the whole world. That's a good thing to care about. But there's such an emphasis that at some level, I think it's because we don't want to look good different. If we take care of Jews, we're parochial. We're focused on Jews. If we're if all of our focus is on Darfur, not a bad thing to care about, by the way, of course. But if everything is Tikkun Olam, Tikkun Olam, Tikkun Olam, then we're like everyone else. We're humanistic. We're caring about the entire world. We're contributing. So they wanted to have Jews having a global message, which of course it does without the Tikkun Olam focus. And they felt that the political and social and cultural environment was such that we could become full-fledged Russian citizens. Not like Catherine said, that Jews are a separate entity. Not like Catherine put us into the Pale of Settlement and closed the doors and literally locked the Jews out of all of the major cities. It would be the equivalent of putting the Jews basically in Alabama and Mississippi, nothing against those states, maybe Louisiana, actually a little bit more, Louisiana, and maybe a couple more states. But then you can't live in Birmingham. You can't live in New Orleans. You can't live in any of the major cities. And when you are going to be selling things, you have certain taxes which the rest of the American population doesn't have. You can't be successful. But if maybe we would dress like them, we would talk like them, and we would act like them, and we wouldn't be so Hasidic for sure not, we would be accepted. We'd be great. And like Galicia, the first line of attack for the Maskilim were the Hasidim, because the Hasidim by its nature is an insular movement. Hasidim says, be more Jewish. Right? You know what we call Yiddish means Jewish. To speak Yiddish, that's Yiddish. The word Yiddish means Jewish. Yeah, that's Yiddish. You dress Jewish. You live Jewish. You have cultural Judaism. It's part of our, not just secular culture, but Judaism. It's part of who we are. And the Hasidim became against the enemy. Now, the beginning with the Misnagdim, with the yeshiva world, the Torah class, it wasn't as cantankerous. For a couple of reasons. First of all, by 1840, up to that point, it was still a heavy battle between this, a couple of years ago, between the Misnagdim and the Hasidim. They had a joint enemy. And the Hasidim weren't so popular in the Misnagdic circles at that time. As I mentioned, it would take the Zionist, secular Zionism, to unite, and the communists, the secular Zionists and communists, to unite the Hasidic world and the Lithuanian world, the Misnagdic world, together to make a good Israel. It would take that pressure, because much more powerful, ultimately, than the Haskalah would be Zionism, secular Zionism and communism. That would be a future discussion. But the Misnagdim at the time are fighting the Hasidim. So if the Misnagdim are fighting the Hasidim, they can't be that bad. They're not that bad! And now the Misnagdim, they're kluger. They're smart. I remember, I always said to my Bubby, grew up in Poland, in Hasidic Poland. She said, well, in Poland, they used to always say the Lithuanian Vilna, they're the smart ones. Well, they're Torah, they're intellectual, they're learning a high level of Talmud. We'll pick them. But that would change in 1840, because in 1840, the Maskilim tried to get the government involved. And they had help. In 1840, the Minister of Education of Russia was a person named Sergei Uvarov, who had a vision of Russifying the Jews of Russia. He wished to reform the Jews by bringing them more in harmony with their surrounding society, at the same time to free Jews from the damaging influence of the Talmud. From the damaging influence of the Talmud, which was a common refrain in the Tsar's palace. The damaging influence of the Talmud. The Talmud, almost like the Romans, you know, going back to 15 classics, the Romans, when they banned the study of the Talmud, the damaging, you can see it almost in all societies in Rome, the damaging influence of the Talmud. You get to Russia, the damaging influence of the Talmud, basically giving Jews spiritual succor to be successful. Uvarov recommended having six district commissions in the Pale, which had representatives to disseminate education and culture and Russian culture, and immediately, again, remember the Pale is filled with Hasidic courts, with Torah centers. It hit opposition. The Maskilim jumped for joy. But the Torah centers were so strong, and the Hasidic centers had no effect. So the next thing he did was recruit a young clergyman by the name of Max Lilienthal, who at the time had a secular school in Riga, Latvia, which is now Riga, Latvia. And he told him what he would like to do is start a rabbinic seminary and an alternative plan of schools in Russia. And it would be such a benefit for Russian Jews. And Max Lilienthal said, yeah, sounds great. I'll help you out. And he ran and went to Minsk. And he told the Jews of Minsk, the Russians are going to love us. All we have to do is open schools. You know, we'll call our kids Boris. We'll drink vodka like them. We'll beat our wives and they'll love us. Mm-hmm. Of course, Max Lilienthal got kicked out of Minsk. He had to run for his life out of Minsk. Now, Minsk, by the way, for many years, you think what happened to Minsk? Minsk was a city where Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky came from, Rabbi Aaron Cutler came from, Reuven Gazelski, three of the greatest Torah leaders in American Jewry post-World War II. Were born in Minsk. Minsk was a Torah center. It was wiped off the map by the communists. Minsk at the time was a Torah, it was the whole fabric, the river of Minsk was Torah. He kicked them out. Went to Vilna, which had actually had a circle of Maskilim. Even there, he was unsuccessful. We went back to Uvarov, and Uvarov gave him a paper. And now he went around. And the paper said that they want to have a rabbinical conference in St. Petersburg, and they want rabbis to come. So at this point, he had a few shalom, because people were concerned that, you know, we'll get to it in a few moments, when Nikolai I was no one you wanted to mess around with. Just to give an appreciation, at some level, for the Jews, he was worse than a Stalin. Okay? He was not somebody you would want to say no to. He was then the Tsar of Russia. So he was actually able to get together a rabbinic conference in 1843 in St. Petersburg. Who was at this conference? The greatest Misnagdic Rav of the generation in Russia, Rabbi Yitzchak of Volozhin, who was the son of Chaim Volozhin, who I mentioned started the great yeshiva of Volozhin, Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who was the head of Chabad Hasidus at the time, not the Menachem Mendel Schneerson who passed away 20 years ago. That was a older one of them, was a Tzemach Tzedek in Chabad circles. He was at this meeting. Rabbi Yisrael Halpern, who was a from Chassidicha Jew, also extraordinarily wealthy on top of it. And the first, fourth person was a person named Bethel Stern, who was the head of the Maskilim in Odessa. And during this council, Lilienthal said we're going to have to do this, it needs to be. But ultimately, with Itzel of Elojim, and the rabbis took the day, and what happened is Lilienthal was able to start a school system that had no support. So in 1844, an official proclamation by Russian Tsar was to start a second set of schools, primary schools, several secondary schools, and two rabbinical seminaries. Most of the graduates and people in the school, very few people went, most were poor, ended up converting to Christianity. So much so that Lilienthal left, realizing it is really the whole focus of it was to get Jews to convert to Christianity. Lilienthal then went to America, to a city called Cincinnati, and became a Reform rabbi, former clergyman in Cincinnati. That's where Matthew was. He was Isaac Weiss's buddy in Cincinnati. This working together of the Maskilim with the Russian government, which was rabidly anti-Semitic, changed all of the equation on the ground. In the eyes of the Maskilim, it empowered them. It made them much more sure that they can get their agendas across. In the eyes of the masses of religious Jews, they became dangerous, crooked, wicked, and threatening. This creased the chasm, and as we'll see in the next stage, it would make both sides more radical against each other. Before we leave this stage, it's worth to say that the nickname that the Maskilim were given in the 1840s, 1850s, were the Berliners. In Russia, they used to call them Maskilim Berliners because at the time, they had a very heavily German influence. And for the religious groups, being called a Berliner was a pejorative. For the Maskilim, oh, I'm a Berliner. Because remember, Berlin at the time was in the time of Nietzsche and Kant, and post-Kant, but Hegel and others, it was considered certainly a compliment in their eyes. In 1856, the hated Nikolai I passes away, and Alexander II, who was supposed to be more liberal-minded, takes over. And now the Maskilim are euphoric. This is our chance! He will give us our rights to be full Russians. And indeed, Alexander II ended the Cantonist decrees, which we'll discuss shortly, and at some level was more welcoming to the Jews. In 1863, the Poles revolted against the Russian Empire. And it was brutally put down. And one of the things that Alexander II then did was try to Russify all of the Pale's area, because the Poles had revolted. So no longer was it okay for Maskilim to speak German. Who would speak German? We're now Russifying everything. So everything became, the emphasis became on Russian culture, Russian life, Russian economy. And the push then became for Russia. And even the Jews who were learning in the Yiddish circles and the Russian circles, they lost a lot of Jews. Because once they got to the Russian circles, many of the Maskilim assimilated totally into Russian culture. Like in Germany, like in America today, you know, you can go from Reform to the Netherworld to completely, like, you know, most people you speak to, well, this guy's Jewish in Silicon Valley. You ask him, what does he do with the Jewish community? Nothing! Zero! His only Judaism is his name. So these Russian Maskilim, many of them completely left Judaism. But there are many who stayed. And what they now tried to do was try to convert, to missionize the rest of Russian Jewry to their point of view. And they found something called the Chevret Marbel Haskala Beisrael, the Society for Promotion of Culture Amongst Jews of Russia, aka OPE. The most prominent expression were certain people. Now these individuals hated traditional Judaism. They not only hated traditional Judaism, they hated anything to do with it. One of the most prominent was a person, these people, you know, it's not like, you know, Noam Chomsky today. You know, you imagine like what they do to Israel, because they're articulate individuals. They're not they were people who could have spread Judaism, but destroyed Judaism in the process. Amongst the most infamous is Mendel Mochar Sofrim, Yaakov Abramowitz, Shalom Aleichem, Yehuda Leib Gordon, Moshe Leib Lilienbaum, and possibly worse than all is Peretz Smolenskin. Just to talk, give you an idea of Peretz Smolenskin, the primary disciple of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who we'll discuss, was the Altony Kelm. The Altony Kelm, Kelm was a city of Lithuania, had the most famous Musar yeshiva. It was always a yeshiva of 30, 40 students. It was a powerhouse yeshiva. And the Altony Kelm was known for his radiance. He was smiling, he was friendly, he was excited. And especially on Shabbos, they said that he would turn, he would be so excited, he would see us as a Jew, Todd responding with a glow in his face. And it was one Shabbos with people looking at him, and it was gloomy, melancholy. So he looked awful. He looked absolutely awful. People were terrified. What happened? What happened? What happened to the altar of Kelm? Well, they were looking, they couldn't understand what happened to him. After Shabbos, he said, Rebbe, what happened to you for Shabbos? We were so nervous. He said that right before Shabbos, he heard that Peretz Smolenskin had died. So Rebbe, what are you so upset about? He's the biggest antagonist of Judaism. He said, the whole Shabbos I was imagining is Gehenna. He's imagining his H-E-L-L. He's imagining what's going to happen to this person who led tens of thousands of the Russian Jews to the spiritual grave. And it bothered him so much that this individual died without doing tshuva. And he led Jews to the grave, spiritual grave. Now in their effort, these authors, Shalom Aleichem and the Mochar Sofrim, Yehuda Leib Gordon, they tried to write in a genre to make the use. I remember I actually read some of these authors, for the fun of it. Anyway, talk about the Shtetl, Shalom Aleichem, by the way, wrote a famous play called Fill in the Roof, just in case you didn't know that. So among other things, they criticized traditional education, patterns of marriage, economic behavior, and the actions of humanity. And the genre they did was to make it into the ultimate evil. So in any stereotypical characters, for example, the Malamid was always, in Haskalic literature, an ignorant and coarse man. An ignoramus. The Malamed, the school teacher, he didn't know anything. He's lucky he knew an Aleph or Beis. And the community feng shui, the community, the religious leader, the lay leaders, he was aggressive in every book. He was violent, temperamental. And the rabbi, a fanatic. We're constantly in halakhic restrictions. The rabbi, of course, the rabbi was radical. In contrast, these novels, when he talked about figures of enlightenment, he was a young, brilliant man dreaming about a beautiful life of Haskalah. The delicate and young, beautiful woman who had so much potential, whose parents wanted her to marry her off to some yeshiva bachar. Oh, poor girl. There was the maskil who gets into Russian society and everybody loves, everybody cares for her. So, by the way, when we get to American Jewry and discuss it, when you look at how American, who created the motion picture industry in this country, it's not surprising that the jazz singer was the first movie. Right? That Al Jolson is playing an intermarried Jew, who was him, his own life, who's able to daven Kaddish in the Ilo, because that's the picture. You can make it. Jazz singer, you can make it in America. They portrayed it. It's like an American Jew will make their own image. The Russian Jews, if you want to be great, you'll be a Russian Jew who's successful, and they'll give examples of Russian Jews who are not that Jewish that they made in the world. But the rabbis got a special place. I don't think they really liked the rabbis, because remember how I started. The rabbis were the highest of the system. They're the Hasidic rebels. They were untouchable. And the Rosh Yeshivas of the Yeshivas, they were all powerful. And the rabbis, the Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, if you were in Brisk, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik's your rabbi, well, he's the competition. What do you think Reb Chaim Soloveitchik had to say about Haskalah? Mm-hmm. He's the one who's going to blast you. Hey, the Malbim is the Rav of Bucharest. They went after the Malbim, this is in Romania. They went after him tooth and nail. There's a famous story with the Malbim, that somebody, they sent him a picture of a pig. that, you know, so he sent back the head of the Maskilim. So he sent them back his picture. Said, "Thanks for your picture. Here's mine." But they went after him. I mean, it's not the rabbis were the number one target, because the rabbis were the ones who looked after the Maskala, and they were the head of the hierarchy. So they portrayed an unbridgeable gap between religion and life. Right? And that the rabbis who interpreted how it's so archaic, they're living in the Middle Ages, they're not contemporary, they're not progressive, they don't understand what's going on in the world, they never left their cave. Right? Basically, they think that, you know, they don't know what science is. I was once reading someone who was in a secular paper, like, they're talking about religious Jews. Yeah, they don't know what grass is. They don't know what trees are. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, they were describing, it was in Israel. I was reading that, they were trying to describe a certain community. They don't know what grass and trees are. Like, do people believe this stuff? You know, they're telling religious, because they would make the rabbis into hermits who were clueless. And they were not contemporary. Lilienbaum had a whole plan that we have to reform Judaism. Right? Moshe Lilienbaum was to reform Judaism because, almost like reform in Germany, because our halakhic process, you know, we went a little bit too far. We make it more loosey, kind of like a conservative years later. Make it more loose, make it more free. It would be part of Russian society. He was unsuccessful. Interestingly, Lilienbaum became one of the heads of the Russian dynasty years later. And as we'll see, one of the reasons why the Orthodox in Russia and the secular Zionist leaders would never get along was people like Lilienbaum were the ones who were founding Russian Zionism. That's a different lecture. For years, though, they tried to get traditional rabbis to change. But one of the things that happened is if you were, you know, there's no question, even in the 9th century, the Shtetl life had much to be desired. There were things that could have been finessed, there were things that should have been worked out. And there were many even traditional rabbis who could have been honest enough to say there were problems. Many of the problems were induced because they had a very oppressive system. And when your hands are tied and your feet are shackled, there's not that much you can do. They had all things stacked up against them, as living as religious Jews. But there were people who would have done good changes, but the problem is if the Maskilim were doing it, we were against it. And the religious attitude became that anything the Maskilim were being involved in, we couldn't be involved in for 2 reasons. Number one is we give them credence. And number two is if there's an opening, they're going to say, oh, they really agree with us. Hey, they're on our side. And especially in certain circles, in the Hasidic circles in particular, the Maskilim were heretics. And even today, if you go to Laurel Park, even specifically like Lakewood, and you say the word Maskil, it's the biggest pejorative. These were people who destroyed Judaism. Who destroyed Judaism. Who took Jews, you know, who were God-fearing and made them cynics. Who ripped away the Jewish past and gave them no future, as we'll see. By the second half of the 1870s, it became clear that radical Haskalah reached that end. That is because radical Haskalah, the few people that actually affected in Russia, became completely assimilated. And ultimately speaking, it wasn't that appealing because most of what radical Haskalah was offering was a debasement of traditionalism, of traditional Jewish world. Another thing happened. By the mid-1870s, pogroms spread out. In fact, in 1871, in Odessa, the most assimilated city in all of Russia, which was the center of Russian assimilation in Haskalah, there was a terrible pogrom, which meant at the end of the day, even if you dressed Russian, even if you talked Russian, even if you were the latest of Russian authors, you were still a Jew. You were still a dirty Jew. And for all the talk of assimilation, just dress like them and talk like them, they didn't let the Jews assimilate. And as mentioned, other Jews, were not taken. We'll get back to what happened with Haskalah afterwards. Now, what was the Orthodox response to Haskalah? So, Haskalah, going back to Galitza, perhaps the first major opponent I discussed in Western Europe, Rav Hirsch, and Rav Hildesheim, the last time in Germany, so we're not going to go back to them, was the Chassam Sofer, or the Moshe Sofer Schreiber, who was the greatest rabbi in Central Europe in the early 19th century. The Chassam Sofer was a teacher of tens of thousands and influenced to our days hundreds of thousands and millions of Jews. He was a gadol, a great, great sage in Torah. His works are studied daily in yeshivas around the world, both on the Torah, on the Bible. He's a commentary. He has a classic book on Shas, on the Gemara. His responsa are famous. His halachic pesachim are famous. He was Rav of Bratislava, which at the time was called Pressburg, which was one of the greatest cities in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And he was a fierce opponent of reform in Haskalah. He was born in Frankfurt in 1762, during the Seven Years' War. At age 9, he entered the yeshiva of Rav Nosson Adler of Frankfurt, who was Rav Nosson Adler, one of the great sages of the generation. And by 13, he was so great that Rav Pinchas Horowitz, the Hafla, asked him to study by him. At a very young age, in 1794, he became a Rav in Austria-Hungary. Late in 1797, he was the Rav of Mattersdorf, which is one of the seven communities of the seven Kehillas of Burgenland. And eventually, in 1806, he became the Rav of Bratislava in Pressburg, where he was the Rav for 33 years. They passed away in 1839. He founded the greatest yeshiva in Central Europe, which was Pressburg, which educated hundreds and eventually thousands of students. The yeshiva was in 1938-39, really, was moved by his great-grandson, Rabbi Akiva Sofer, to Jerusalem, where it is to this day. And the Chassam Sofer was the greatest sage of Central Europe. He was fierce. He made a part of his life to fight against reform and Haskalah. He had a motto. His motto was Chadash Aser Min HaTorah, that what is new is forbidden by the Torah. Now, the Chassam Sofer, by the way, knew mathematics, knew astronomy, knew science. But what he meant is any innovation in Judaism that's coming from a secular world is by nature puzzle, is by nature null and void. And any change that took place, he came in. It's a very funny story, actually. The Chassam Sofer himself, he would speak out against any change in the maskilim and the reform and everything about to do with them. So one time, of course, the Chassam Sofer was known. He traveled to an inn before internet, before pictures were prolific. He traveled to an inn, didn't know who he was. He made Kiddush on Shabbos in this inn, and he didn't say the psukim, the verses for Kiddush. And the hotel owner thought he was a Moscow, and he kicked him out of the hotel. He got the Chassam Sofer. So they asked the Chassam Sofer, what do you think of this hotel owner? He said, about the hotel owner, I don't know. But one thing I know, his grandchildren will be Jewish. So if he cares so much about those psukim, his grandchildren will be Jewish. Right? Chassam Sofer had a very strong line. And actually, to this day, in certain Hasidic communities, and even part of the Haredi world, this idea of Chadash Aser Min HaTorah is a basic doctrine of how they deal with it. Of course, we're not Quaker. They're not Quakers. They listen to phones and that. But innovation in Judaism is inherently suspect. What's making you innovate? What's making you do things? Well, there are certain things that were even the Chassam Sofer accepted, and we'll discuss them that shortly. But why are you innovating? What's making you do things? Is it the New York Times? Is it Thomas Friedman? Is it Maureen Dowd? Is what she says anything intelligent? No. But is doubt what's encouraging you? Or is it the Torah? Or is it making Torah successful? The Chassam Sofer says, look into yourself. What's making you dress this way? What's making you talk this way? You want to change the way you do Kiddush? Why? And he said, if anything, any change is suspect. Chassam Sofer's second wife, his first wife passed away, he died childless. His second wife, he married the daughter of the great, great Gadol Hador, Rabbi Akiva Eiger. He had 10 children, and there are great, great, great descendants of his today. The Sofer family is well known in New York, in Jerusalem, and in Israel. There are great, great, great descendants. Many of them are very famous. And he died in 1839. In Lithuania, besides the Hasidic movement, there was next major come against the Haskalah was the yeshivas. Now, advanced Torah study in the beginning of the 19th century was a luxury. Was a luxury. But in 1803, looking what there were the current winds of change that were starting to blow, Rabbi Chaim Volozhin, the primary student of the Vilna Gaon, set up to change and to revolutionize the concept of a yeshiva. What most days, in those days, you go to the rabbi of the town, and little groups of people studying with the rabbi of the town, and it was a small situation. In 1803, he sent letters to the chief rabbis throughout Europe, asking them to send their best students and donations to his yeshiva, which he was going to open in Volozhin, Lithuania. The yeshiva was later named Eitz Chaim, the tree of Chaim, named after Rabbi Chaim Volozhin. After Rabbi Chaim Volozhin passed, it was called Eitz Chaim. In fact, Yeshiva University in New York was originally a branch of Eitz Chaim in New York. There's an Eitz Chaim in Jerusalem. Eitz Chaim is a popular name afterwards. So look at source number one. This was the letter he wrote. There are those who wish to study and have no financial means to do so, and those who wish to study and are financially able to do so, but have no teacher to guide them in the true path of analytical study. And they are like sheep without a shepherd, and even though I am unworthy of a crown that does not truly befit me, nevertheless I see a time not far distant when the Jewish people will be without leaders, and the doors of the house of study will be locked. Therefore, do I call all of my beloved brethren to hear the truth, to repair the breach in our wall, to support God's Torah through this yeshiva with all our might, whether by supplying proper students, whether by providing necessary financial support. And the response was very positive, and the yeshiva within a decade had 450 students, and to get into the yeshiva was very, very difficult. And they were supported. Rav Chaim Volozhin was the first one to innovate sending out mishulachim. The first, the idea of sending out mishulachim, which means collectors, to all the towns of Lithuania and Poland to collect for Volozhin, that first time that ever occurred was for the Volozhin yeshiva. That was Rav Chaim's innovation. But Rav Chaim, not only changed the yeshiva, he became the first Rosh Yeshiva. He made the style of Rosh Yeshiva was a leader. He was a teacher. He was a Rebbe. He had analytical studies for the students. He would encourage them. He was a critic. He was a boss. And in a sense, he became the prototype Rosh Yeshiva that we have to our very day. And the yeshiva was outstandingly successful. Almost all of the rabbis in the 19th century that led Lithuanian, Latvian, Russian, Polish towns were products of Volozhin. But because of its success, of course, it became under the scrutiny of the Russian authorities. And in 1879 already, they tried to close down the yeshiva unless they had secular studies from 9 to 3. Basically went to have four secular studies from 9 to 3. And finally, in 1892, the yeshiva was shut closed. So it was less than 100 years. However, because of Volozhin, dozens of other yeshivas opened up in its wake. And today, of course, today, it's almost axiomatic that Orthodox children have day school yeshiva background. In fact, in America, the statistics are something between 96 and 97% of Orthodox Jews send their children to yeshivas. It's considered, everything being equal, spiritual death. And where I came from, in the East Coast, if you didn't send your kid to yeshiva, you were out of your mind. That's how you viewed. That's how strong the yeshiva movement became in the Orthodox world. Right, that yeshiva not only became an elitist group, eventually it will become a mainstay. That if you wanted your children to thrive as Jews, they have to be knowledgeable Jews. You Torah study not just for the elite. You want your children to be from? Send them to yeshiva. You want at least a day school. You want your children to be a Torah Jew? You want your children to be a Torah Jew? You want them to be able to study Torah? A yeshiva became a requirement. Another thing that opened in the mid-19th century, really in response to the Haskalah, was the Musar movement. And the Musar movement, or I think if you look at secular books, they're called the Morality Movement. Right? The Morality Movement. It sounds like, you know, some Puritan group somewhere going. Right? The Musar movement sounds a lot better to me. So the Musar movement was founded by the greatest, the most brilliant sage of the 19th century, Rabbi Yisrael Lipkin of Salant, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And he lived from 1810 to 1883. He was a goyin. He was a genius of geniuses. He was whoever you hear about, whether it's the Soloveitchik or Beis Halevi, or the Yitzchak Elchanan Spector of Kovno, or the Marl Diskin, he was the greatest of all in learning. But what he's most famous for is not his academic learning, not his brilliance in Talmud, but for spreading the Muslim movement. And he's famous for vignettes about his caring about others. Because what Yisrael Salanter did is you had to work on interpersonal relationships. You had to work on the core of Judaism. It was axiomatic then, according to him, you had to dress nicely to impress people. And he actually stole some of the Haskalah's steam by doing that. So one of the famous stories is Yom Kippur night. Yisrael's waiting for Yisrael Salanter. Everyone's waiting. It's Kol Nidre. Where's the rabbi? Where's Yisrael Salanter? We can't start the davening without him. They start looking through the town, and they find him with a baby. Apparently, a mother had left her baby to go to Kol Nidre. Left her baby behind. The baby's sitting there screaming. And as Yisrael Salanter was walking to Kol Nidre, he hears the baby screaming. Looks in the house. No one's there. So he sat down with the baby. Playing with the baby. And they come running to his home. Where are you? That's the baby crying. How can I go to Kol Nidre? Another famous story, and this is his leadership. You know, when the candidates, he would stand up to anyone and everyone to make sure that the kids weren't stolen. And he pushed that all of the yeshivas should study ethical works. But not only study, but focus on it. Focus on it. Work on yourself. Work on being a holy Jew. Learn Musar. Get Yira Shemayim, get fear of God, because if you just do Judaism because you're in a cultural Judaism, you live in a shtetl, and everyone around you is Orthodox, that's not going to make you a God-fearing Jew. You got to study Musar. You got to learn Musar to work on davening. You got to learn to study Musar to work on being a friendly Jew, a loving Jew, a caring Jew. You got to work on Musar to know to fight against Haskalah, not to be a wimp, because you got to stand up for Judaism. And then primary manual of the Musar movement became Mesilas Hashem, the Path of the Just. A work by Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, the great 18th century Kabbalist. Other works became popular as well. The work I was teaching recently, Talmud Devara, 16th century work by Rav Moshe Kor Devara. What Yisrael Salanter tried to do, it's funny, because Reform Judaism and Haskalah tried to change Judaism. Yisrael Salanter tried to change Jews. Remember going way back, I said that Judaism is perfect, Jews are not. Judaism is perfect, Jews are not. Jews have mistakes. We have plenty of things we could improve on. Even today, there's no perfect system for the Jews. There's no community that can say it's perfect. But Jews can always use improvement. Judaism, if it's done correctly, is the best thing in the world. It's God's Torah. So we saw Salanter, we're going to have to change Jews. Now, at first, we were called Am Kshe Orva, or stiff-necked people. Jews get suspicious. Who is he trying to change the yeshivas? Why is it so much a focus on the Musar? And even Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was criticized by Orthodox Jews. What are you trying to do? What are you trying to accomplish? But ultimately, he won the day, and Musar became a part of the curriculum in all major, in the vast majority of major of yeshivas. Certainly, lectures today. Anyone's been to my lectures? I think there's a Musar component. Musar is a reality in the Jewish world today. The most famous, though we could use more of it, the most famous Musar yeshivas were Kelm, as I mentioned, Nevardok, which was all opened in 1896 by the Rabbi Joseph Nevardok, and ultimately established 70 branches, mostly in Poland. And Slobodka, in 1884, started by Rabbi Nassim Zvi Finkel, which later moved to Hebron in Israel, was destroyed in Hebron, and now is a branch in Jerusalem, and in Bnei Brak. Other yeshivas was the Mir Yeshiva, which was a small yeshiva in 1815, but became great in 1921, beginning of 1900, when the ultimate Slobodka, Rabbi Finkel, sent his son, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Finkel, to Mir to build up the yeshiva. Telz, which was founded in 1875 in Telz, Lithuania, now has a branch in Cleveland, Chicago, Riverdale, New York, as well. And the city of Telstone in Israel, of course, there's a Telz branches there as well. And Slutsk, one of my favorite yeshivas, Slutsk, I'm sure everyone remembers Slutsk, was founded in Slutsk in 1896, when the communists came over and moved from Slutsk, Russia, to Kletsk, Lithuania in 1920, they escaped over the border. Kletsk, the Rosh Yeshiva, was Israel Meltzer, and when he left to Israel in 1925, his son, Aaron Cutler, took over, and today Kletsk is called Lakewood Yeshiva. It's the biggest yeshiva in America, in Lakewood, New Jersey. That was Slutsk, Kletsk, Lakewood. That the yeshiva movement took in the Muslim movement, and so now, not only yeshivas did you have a Rosh Yeshiva, you had a Mashkiach. The Mashkiach was in charge of giving Musar and making sure that the students in the yeshiva had, were on time to davening, were not only academically excellent, but were spiritually excellent as well. Another response to Haskalah, because the yeshivas had power and the Muslim women had power, well, what about the girls? I remember I once met a Ger Chassid, he told me this, that before Beis Yaakov came to his town, his father and all his brothers remained religious, and all his aunts, the older Ger Chassid, all his aunts became secular. All of them became actually Zionists, secular Zionists, not religious Zionists. And it was Beis Yaakov, Sara Schneer was living in Krakow, and she's looking around, and she sees Jewish girls without any education. My grandmother, so both of my babies grew up in Poland. One of my grandmothers, Hasidic background, as you can imagine, she went to public school. She told me she remembers her friends making fun of her father when he would come to visit her at school. Her Polish friends. What is that person? She was embarrassed of her father. My grandmother told me. When she saw her father, she used to run away. She didn't want her friends to make fun of her. And they went to public school. My other grandmother, her father, established the Beis Yaakov in her town in Poland because he was so concerned about her. Beis Yaakov came because Sarah Schneer was a seamstress in Poland, and she said she was making dresses for Jewish girls. She saw that they had no soul. Right? Here she was giving them a physical garment. They were lacking education. So with the approbation of the greatest tzaddik and good sage of the generation, the Chafetz Chaim, and the Ger Nova, in the beginning of the 20th century, the Beis Yaakov movement started to have mass Jewish education for girls, and that, of course, took root today. It's every Jewish girl, you know, has, you know, whether the Beis Yaakov in New York, Israel, now Meir Academy in our own Bay Area, or Florida. It's part of the world, but that was a response to a secular world which was encroaching on Judaism. As mentioned, more than anything, perhaps, why the Haskalah was not successful was because no matter what you did in Russia, you were still a Jew. You were still hated. So just to go back for a moment or two, Tsar Nikolai I probably was the cruelest, most brutal of any of them. And in 1827, in the third year of his reign, he had a decree called the Cantonist Decrees, which meant he took boys for 25 years of service. Right? Nikolai wrote in a memorandum, the chief benefit is to be derived from drafting of the Jews is a certainty that it will move them most effectively to change their religion. And Simon Dubnow, which was a famous Russian Jewish historian, he also wrote that the barrack was to serve as a school, or rather a factory, for producing a new generation of de-Judaized Jews who were completely Russified and, if possible, Christianized. So the Cantonist Decrees, started in 1827, took Russian Jewish children at young ages for 25 years of service, and they would beat them daily unless they prayed with the priest. They would take away from their parents at a young age. Officially, it was supposed to be from 12 to 18-year-olds, but most of them were 8 or 9 years old. And the reason is because they were kidnapped. They couldn't get quotas. And ultimately what happened is most of the boys that were taken to the campus were kidnapped from the poorest families, or they were orphans at young ages, and they were thrown into the Russian army. The effect of this was so traumatic on the Jewish community, because they were put a gun into that. Some communities did things which are unspeakable because they were forced, or when you think back to how the Nazis forced Jewish councils to pick the Jews to go to the death, That's really what they forced certain communities to do. They had to pick the kids. And ultimately what happened is people were kidnapping kids because their own kid was going to go. They didn't want that. So they would take the kids who had no protection, no one to watch out for them, take them and throw them into the Russian army. One of the things that we saw a lot there went screaming town to town about were these kind of things going on. And if it wasn't bad enough for this, which was taken away in 1856, there was government-sponsored anti-Semitism. For example, just jumping ahead, in 1933, there was the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was written by the Russian secret police in 1903, which, according to many accounts in history, is the second biggest seller after the Bible. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion is more, and probably the Quran, I can take that back. I think they're counting the rest of the world. Supposedly, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion was a secret meeting. Now, it was based off the 1897 First World Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. And it was a secret meeting that every 100 years, the Jews get together to plot the world. That all the rabbis gather together in a cemetery. And they all sit and figure out, how are we going to rule the next 100 years? Right? How will we rule? It's such a preposterous book that it only could anti-Semitic be so irrational to read it. Well, guess who loved these books? Well, I don't have to tell you a surprise. Adolf Hitler, one of his favorite books, quotes in Mein Kampf. How about Henry Ford? Henry Ford published the book, sponsored 500,000 copies of the book to be written. By the way, they interviewed Nazis, the American army interviewed Nazis, and there were many Nazis who said that the number one influence on them was Henry Ford. Just to know what kind of anti-Semite he was. He was awarded by the Nazis in 1938 an award for helping German culture. And his Dearborn Independent constantly was filled with anti-Semitic stuff. He was sued in 1927, so he stopped to an extent. But he published the protocols, he published other anti-Semitic creeds as well. The Egyptian president Gamal Nasser, in fact, in the Arab world today, the protocols were constantly sold. King Fahd of Saudi Arabia. And if any of us want to buy it, we can buy it. Go to Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, Freedom of Speech. Right? And it's on the internet, anyone can get it. Besides the protocols, the Elders of Zion, there were state-sponsored programs. Now, why would the Russian Tsar have state-sponsored programs? Simple. Because as the 19th century ends, at the time of Alexander III, right, where it got much worse, the government was under duress. And you need scapegoats. And the Jews were the best scapegoats. So they started blaming the Jews for everything. And more pogroms were happening, especially when Alexander III took over. He, not only did he have pogroms, but in the May laws of the 1880s, he said as follows. One, it is henceforth forbidden to produce or settle outside of the cities and townships. He started limiting again where they could live. They couldn't register property. They couldn't do commerce on Sundays or Christian holidays. Look at source number two. Expulsions, deportations, arrests, and beatings became the daily lot of the Jews, not only of the lower class, but even of the middle class. And the Jewish intelligentsia, the government of Alexander III, waged a campaign of war against its Jewish inhabitants. The Jews were driven and hounded, and emigration appeared to be the only escape from the terrible tyranny of the Romanov. In fact, Slobodka, which removed one of its branches to Jerusalem when they moved, the altar of Slobodka said, why are you moving the Yeshiva from Lithuania to Israel? He said, because we feel the ground burning under our feet. The Jews started to feel the ground burning under their feet in the late 1880s in Russia. When Alexander III died, and he was succeeded by Nicholas II, who was the last of the Romanovs, whose inflexibility and incompetence, quite frankly, brought about the Russian Revolution. And he had his number one advisor at the end of his reign was a witchcraft guy named Rasputin, who was, I mean, it's like basic, oh, I don't want to get into our president, but it's like the basic equivalent of having some astrologist come to the president, giving presidential advice, any president, and give them advice how to decide on the stock and taxes, how to decide on government policies. And you're listening to some astrologers, you know, you took from downtown with 8 tattoos. That's who he had helping him out. And in 1903, there was a famous pogrom called the Kishinev pogrom, which received a lot of international attention. Why did it receive so much international attention? Because Western Europe was horrified. Western Europe, Germany, was horrified, and France was horrified. You'd see 40 years later, they wouldn't be so horrified. But in 1903, they were still horrified. They were horrified what happened. And the Tsar said, told the police to stand by and do nothing, as over 118 Jews were slaughtered in the middle of the street. This is source number 3. I'm not going to read the whole source. This is Chaim Nassim of Bialik, the famous author. It's in his piece, The City of Slaughter, describing the Kishinev pogrom. Arise and go now to the City of Slaughter, into its courtyard wind the way. There with thine own hand, touching thy eyes and thine head. Behold, on tree, on stone, on fence, on mural clay, the splattered blood and dry brains of the dead. Right? The Jews were slaughtered in broad daylight as the Russian police watched Russians go from house to house in Kishinev and kill Jews. Okay? And between 1903 and 1907, there was a general unrest in Russia. There was a revolt in 1905. In that time, there were 284 pogroms specifically against Jews, with 50,000 casualties. If you believe at this time in Haskalah, become Russian, they'll love us! That was long forgotten. Nobody thought at that point that Haskalah was the answer to the Jews. What was the answer then? We'll see in the lecture ahead. But what Haskalah did accomplish, it did not accomplish its goals, but it destroyed the fabric of traditional Judaism. So that by the 1880s, after decades of rabbinic Judaism being satire, made fun of, the genre of the Ben Melacha Sovereign, Jews became more invested in outside things. Now we're open to the Bund. In 1820, no Jews were going to the Bund because it was not a religious organization. It's communism, secular Zionism, which was secular Zionism in its root, was anti-religious in the beginning, or non-religious at best in its beginning. Other anarchism, socialism, and everything else but religious Judaism. The Maskilim gave way, many of them, to secular Zionism, which, as mentioned, would cause a rift amongst many of the Orthodox, and we'll get to that in the last lecture, in the beginning of it. But more than anything else, what the Maskilim did was break down a religious culture so that you had Jews like Trotsky come. You had Jews like Zinoviev. Gregory Zinoviev. I have too many Russians here getting nervous to say the names. You had Jews like Lev Kamenev come up who had zero Judaism. The unbelievable thing is that they had known nothing. Most of these Jews had been left Judaism in the 1850s and 1860s. And you had Jews who communism would be the worst thing for their own selves ultimately. They would shoot themselves in the head, and one of the first things that the communists did in the Yevetzkin would become against the rest of the yeshivas. Shut them down because they had been raised on a diet that traditional Judaism was out to hurt them. And we got to get rid of it. And even though Lenin said no more anti-Semitism, Russia, is before Stalin, Russia will have no more anti-Semitism. The first thing that the Russian Jews were communists was shut down. The last yeshivas, the Beis Yaakovs, that's why the yeshivas had to run out of Russia. That's why it was Hashkacha, it was divine providence that Poland, Lithuania, and Latvia were not under them. One other result of the severe pogroms, government sponsored anti-Semitism throughout the later parts of the 19th century, especially after the murder of Alexander II in 1881, one other strong result that happened was emigration for Jews. As mentioned, the ground started to burn under the feet of the Jews. And between 1881 to 1914, 2 million plus Russian Jews left Russia. The vast majority would come to the United States of America. Many of these Jews had lost their Judaism already in Russia. the cousin of the Maskilim, to set up American Jewry. But the coming of America of 2 million Russian Jews, and in general, American Jewry, that will be the topic of next week's lecture. Thank you very much.